For those of us living in the Midwest, tornadoes, kind of a fact of life, but that doesn't mean that we don't take them very seriously. If anything, I think it means that we have a lot of respect for the power that they have. Have you seen a tornado? I saw one and had one kind of knock over a home that I had, actually. Larry Mueller here. Lee Sandlin is an award-winning journalist and essayist who lives in Chicago. He's written several books. His most recent is a fascinating book. It's called Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. He's with us by phone today, and certainly we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Are you kind of an amateur meteorologist? Do you enjoy watching severe weather or tornadoes in particular? Maybe you've chased tornadoes. Maybe you've seen them. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Lee Sandlin, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, pleasure to be with you.
I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, thank you.
You were fascinated with tornadoes and weather even as a young kid, and it's lasted into adulthood, I guess.
Yeah.
What's so intriguing about it?
Well, tornadoes have always had a certain fascination. You know, when I was a kid, I was a kid in the 60s, and that was long before video and long before YouTube had hour after hour of tornado footage on it. So tornadoes were very rare sights in those days. So that gave them an air of mystery. They still do have it, but back then they were really very strange and spooky apparitions.
And in you do a good job of describing what happens in a tornado. You take you talk about a pot of water on a stove.
Yeah.
Why don't you share that?
Well, the key idea is that tornadoes are a kind of safety valve in the atmosphere, in that they are a way of getting a lot of very hot air at the surface of the Earth up into the upper atmosphere very quickly. And the way to visualize that, which is the best way that I could come up with, is if you imagine a pot of water on the stove, it's being heated from underneath. And as the heat builds underneath, the water in the pot gets more and more unstable. And what happens, it's a phenomenon called convection, is that when the heat starts to rise, it doesn't rise generally through the pot at random. It goes through very specific points. It forms little columns in the water. And those little columns in the water, that same thing happens in the atmosphere when under similar circumstances there, and those columns are what form all kinds of movements of the air, including tornadoes.
Yeah, interesting. It took a long time for scientists, and this is what's kind of really fascinating, one of the fascinating things about your book. It took them a long time to figure out that those were the elements at play. And maybe you can talk about some of the initial theories of what caused tornadoes.
Well, the thing that you have to understand, and it's a very puzzling thing about human psychology, is that up until about 200 years ago, nobody really realized that storms had different kinds of forms at all. That there was any practical difference, say, between a tornado or a hurricane or a thunderstorm or a gale. And in fact, when you read early accounts of weather in America and in Europe as well, in Asia, these terms will all be used interchangeably. They would call something a tornado or a hurricane or a cyclone or a gale in the same sentence. They didn't draw any distinctions at all. They didn't see that storms had characteristic patterns. So the first breakthrough really was in seeing that the atmosphere took on certain underlying forms, and that you could understand those forms. And that's actually a pretty new idea. It wasn't really around before the early 19th century.
It's amazing. I thought it was so cool. Ben Franklin, of course, his experiments, and then you recount the story of him. And his son, I think, writing.
Yeah, they chased a tornado.
Chased a tornado.
Yeah, he was the first tornado chaser on record. this happened. He and a bunch of his friends were riding through the Maryland countryside, and a very small tornado formed in a valley they were passing through. And everybody sort of reared back in alarm. And Franklin was absolutely fascinated by it and went racing off after it on horseback. And in one of the letters that he accounts for this, he claims he was riding alongside it and lashing it with his riding crop to see if he could get it to break up.
That was a great story.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I loved it. Don in Warren, Illinois, has a comment or question. Hi, Don.
Hi. I'm an old bugger, and when I was growing up, there was a picture in one of my books at school of it looked like a Dust Bowl situation with a man with baggy overalls standing with a storm door open with one hand and looking off to the distance and his little boy standing next to him. And there are five tornadoes on the ground. I have never seen that picture. And the weather guys, I think I spoke to them, and they've never seen it. Have you ever seen that picture?
I have not seen that particular picture. I have seen video. Someone actually managed to get video of multiple tornadoes. I think he got six distinct funnel clouds on the ground at the same time. So multiple tornadoes do happen. They're quite rare. But they can happen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Don, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And I always take Jack in Cedarburg as well. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. I have a little story and then a question to follow it up with. When I was younger, I lived in Madison, and there were a tornado. I think it was around 2003. And I lived in a neighborhood, and the tornado, seemingly how it was told to me, was hit a hill and it jumped over our neighborhood. Now, we don't have a basement in our house. Our neighbor does. So we ran outside to get into their basement. And when we went out, I distinctly remember looking up and the tornado was literally right above our house, just up in the air. And I couldn't say how many feet, you know, it might have been 100, it might have been 30. I'm not 100% sure. But I remember looking directly up through the tornado and seeing boards and roofs flying around inside of it. And I just thought it was very interesting. And is that a correct assumption of what happened? Does it sort of hit a hill, and can they do that, jump over an entire neighborhood?
Well, not exactly.
Not exactly.
But what can happen is that tornadoes are very complex. They look like one thing, but they're in fact a bunch of different events happening at the same time. And what can sometimes happen near the surface is that it can break up a bit, and you can find yourself looking up. There are accounts of people. I haven't seen this myself. I was in a tornado, but I never saw anything like this. But you can, if the lower levels dissipate a little bit, you can see up into the internal structure of the tornado. And it's very common to see that kind of debris flying around. So, yeah, I don't think you did see into it. I think your memory is correct. But of it skipping over the hillside, once a tornado is on the ground, it tends to stay there. People used to think they skipped and rose and fell. But meteorologists now think what instead happens is they tend to break up and reform.
Yeah, that's one of the kind of the myths you talk about near the end of end of your book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jack, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show with your questions or comments about severe storms and Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers, written by Lee Sandlin, our guest today. Great to have him along. Most of us, I learned about Franklin's experiments with lightning and electricity, but what did he contribute to the study? Although you tell a great story about it, about the kite in your book.
Yes, yeah.
But maybe tell that story and then what he contributed to the study of tornadoes.
Well, he did the kite experiment not because he was terribly interested in meteorology as such. He was somebody who, you know, people have this image of Franklin as being this kind of model of prudence and steady application and consistent, you know, and so forth. But he was really kind of this intellectually very flighty guy. He was constantly darting around from one idea to another. And he investigated thunderstorms only because he wanted to know what the nature of static electricity was. And that was his first starting point. And when he turned out to be correct in proving that lightning was a form of static electricity, everybody automatically assumed he was now an authority on weather. And so he started learning about weather. And he became fascinated by, you know, they didn't really know about tornadoes at that point. They're very rare on the East Coast of the United States, and the interior of the country was still, as far as the settlers goes, entirely unknown terrain, and they don't really occur much of anywhere else in the world. They did know about water spouts. And because they saw sailors saw them often along the equator. And so he knew about those and he was fascinated by those. And that was really his starting point for thinking about violent weather and storms. And when he began working on what the logic of weather spouts, of water spouts was, he started wondering if something like that could happen on land. And that was the first real systematic attempt to find out if there were such a thing as a tornado.
And I think you report on a water, I'm trying to remember now, a water spout that actually goes on land or went on land.
Yeah, it happened in the Mediterranean in, I believe it was 1750, as a huge water spout appeared off the coast of Italy and then came ashore, terrified the people to no end, and led to a lot of interest among European scientists as to what this was, and that was where Franklin first read about them.
And there were some incredibly heated debates about what was going on in a tornado.
Oh, yeah.
Whether there was a rotational effect in the tornado. That led to some fistfights almost.
Well, you know, one of the things about tornado experts, scientific experts generally, is they tend to fall in love with their theories. And in the early 19th century, the leading authority on tornadoes and weather generally in America was a man named James Espy, who was the first person to figure out, when I was mentioning convection earlier, he was the first person to work that out. So he made this huge breakthrough. And he understood the tornadoes were a form of convection. But he had this kind of blind spot in that he worked out this beautiful design in his mind for how a tornado worked, but he couldn't imagine that tornadoes rotated because that screwed up his model. It wasn't as pretty. And when people, eyewitnesses would come up to him and say, well, I read this and I think you're right about tornadoes, but you know, the one I saw rotated, he'd say, well, no, you're wrong. Couldn't have.
And he was a great orator.
Yeah, he was. He was the first real weather celebrity. He was the first celebrity scientist in America. There was this movement in those days called the Lyceum Movement. It was sort of like a radio shows now, actually. There were public debates they held all over the country where experts would show up and they'd get into debates with people in the audience. And he was terrific at that. He was a great explainer of his ideas. And he was also really good at holding his own at shouting matches with people who disagreed with him.
Yeah, he could make people think that he could look askance at people and just like as they were arguing against him and make them feel like, or at least those observing, feel like it was so stupid that what the other person was saying.
Yeah, he wasn't a guy overly given to doubt.
No. Oh, man. Talking with Lee Sandlin today. He's written a fascinating book. It's called Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. You can join in, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And, you know, we had an email from Sarah in Milwaukee, and you may or may not know this,
okay,
Lee, but she's wondering, has the frequency of tornadoes changed over the years?
The short answer is no. What's happened is that the observed numbers have increased because our observations are much more sophisticated now. But as far as can be worked out, especially considering violent, the really most destructive tornadoes, that doesn't appear to be changing. You'd think it would with all this talk about global warming. That's currently an extremely hot topic now in discussions of tornadoes as to whether climate change is going to affect tornado strength and frequency. But so far, we have not seen any really strong statistical changes.
One of the fascinating aspects of this story, and you alluded to it a little bit, is that so many tornadoes in the early years of the U.S. happened so far away from the well-settled areas. Most of the European settlers were, of course, in the east, where the Midwest is really tornado central.
Yeah, yeah. They would see the evidence of tornadoes in the forests. You know, during the first half of the 19th century, the eastern half of the country was still basically all forest. And tornadoes would knock down long rows of trees there. They'd find these paths of downed trees in the forest. They called, and that was where I got the title, actually, because they made up this sort of mythological figure called the Storm King. They said, the Storm King is riding, and he knocked down all the trees.
Lee Sandlin, our guest author of Storm Kings. I'm Larry Mueller. Gabby Pedriani, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Lee Sandlin, author of Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. Great fun talking with him today. I really enjoyed reading his book, and I think you will as well. There are some stories in there, by the way, that relate pretty closely to, well, actually are involved Wisconsin, especially the Peshtigo fire, and that whole story is just an amazing story, isn't it?
I've never really encountered much of anything like it. I was spellbound on it when I first came across. And there's still a huge amount of controversy among scientists as to what actually happened at Peshtigo. And the version I present in my book is as close as I get to what the eyewitnesses said they saw. And what they said they saw was the heart of the huge fire that happened there, a tornado of fire formed. And there did this astonishing amount of damage very quickly.
I was just reading that again, and you know, many of us here in Wisconsin have read accounts of it, but I'm telling you, it's always raises the hair on the back of your neck.
Yeah. There have been so few major fire tornadoes. There's still a controversy among some meteorologists as whether they really happen. Although I think it's now pretty much accepted that they do happen, but they're extraordinarily rare.
Yeah.
And the conditions at the heart of one are so extreme, it's really kind of hard to believe they actually happen on this planet. You think it belongs to some sort of science fiction, you know, alien planet.
Michael in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was interested by that anecdote about Ben Franklin chasing and trying to whip or lash the
tornado,
little tornado, whatever. I'm connecting it to those seamen. I know in particular waterspouts came close to Captain Cook's ship. I think when he was off.
Yeah, they fired cannon at them. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly what I was going to say was that they had this idea.
Yeah, that was actually what Franklin himself said gave him the idea. Was reading those very accounts.
That's what I was going to ask you, is whether there was a connection, and do you believe that a cannon could actually disorganize or disperse a tornado or a waterspout?
No, it's not possible. Because tornadoes and waterspouts are just too large for something that small to have an effect. There was actually a scientist in the late 19th century who proposed setting huge caches of dynamite around towns, trying to blow up tornadoes when they came across.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't have worked either for roughly the same reasons. You know, the tornado column is like tens of thousands of feet high and is extraordinarily powerful. So you can imagine something like a cannonball isn't really going to make any impact.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate your call. And Don and Tomahawk, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Really enjoy your show. Listen, I graduated from UW multiple years ago in 62 as a meteorologist, and I spent my Navy career as a meteorologist. I just wanted to mention taking radar pictures during a hurricane penetration on our hurricane hunters. We have all often observed multiple tornadoes, sometimes three, four, I don't ever remember five, but at least four. And people don't understand the total destructive power of these things. The hurricane is bad enough with the water wall and everything else, but these tornadoes that get embedded are just unbelievable, and they do so much destructive damage.
The major force The major destructive force of any tornado is wind. They used to think it was air pressure, but it's wind. And you're right that hurricanes can spawn multiple tornadoes very quickly, and they can come ashore and or come over land in really unpredictable patterns, too. So they can cause a huge amount of chaos and devastation with very little warning. So you're entirely right there.
Yeah. Thanks, Don.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. We have... let's take a call from Dennis. Dennis in Fond du Lacs, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if you knew what the longest duration was that a tornado stayed on the ground and the furthest distance one tornado had traveled.
Yeah, it was. There's two on record, roughly comparable. In fact, they happened in almost exactly the same place. One in 1805 and one in 1925. The one in 1925 is very well documented. It's known as the Tri-State Tornado. It came down in Missouri, crossed the Mississippi into Illinois, cut through all of Illinois, and dissipated finally in Indiana. The average tornado was on the ground for about 20 minutes, and this one was on the ground for at least 4 hours. And there was the earlier one, which happened in 1805, left a similar track of damage. There was very few people around then. They went by the damage trail that was left behind, and it would have had to have been on the ground for around the same time. So the longest you're talking about, 4 to 5 hours rather than 20 minutes.
And you certainly discussed that tornado in your book.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for calling, Dennis. And there was a significant tornado, a different one, and going back further, it was 1835 in New Jersey.
Yeah,
that had a big impact on the study of weather.
Well, that was the first one that happened really in a highly populated area, and it also happened for scientific studies, happened in sort of a lucky place in that it was very close to the major universities where people were studying tornadoes. So that was the first one where you've got this thing that has become very commonplace since then of people in the aftermath trying to rebuild their lives while they're surrounded with these experts asking them questions about what they saw. Because every scientist in America interested in weather basically descended in New Brunswick, New Jersey to study this tornado. They spent an entire summer hanging out there.
Sometimes to the chagrin of those who were trying to clean up.
Just wondering what the hell these guys are doing there, yeah.
Reed in Clintonville, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, good morning, gents.
Morning.
My question concerns the difference between a typhoon and a hurricane. My dad was one of the first Navy personnel to land on Okinawa and said that they had a typhoon. He was landing in a typhoon shortly before. And I'll just hang up and listen on the air here.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, the short answer is that typhoons are hurricanes in the Pacific. Whether you really need a separate word for that, I'm not a hurricane expert, so I can't say for sure. But as I said earlier, one of the problems with studying all of this stuff, especially when you're looking at early records of meteorology, is that nobody can keep any of the terms straight.
Yeah, I suppose this must have been. This is kind of a difficult book. Had to have been a difficult book for you to research in many ways.
It was challenging to do. Yeah, the stories. I mean, I got into it. I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist, and I got spellbound by just the stories of these people and their personalities and just the drama of tornadoes themselves. But I did have to read a lot of 19th century science, which is not very easy to read. First, because they had all their own terms for everything. And second, because a lot of it is wrong, and you got to sit down and work out where they went wrong, which is, not the most exhilarating way of spending your time.
There's so many little interesting facts that you have in the book that I really enjoyed reading. I was reading about the wagon trains.
Yeah.
And what they got into, including big bluestem plants that are so high that they couldn't see where they were going.
Yeah, well, I was really fascinated in a large part about how people came to settle the Midwest and learn to live with things like tornadoes. And one of the things that we forget about the Midwest is that physically it was really kind of a different environment. And we picture sort of close-cropped grass going out to the horizon. But the prairie grass in those days, especially around the Mississippi, is a slightly different species further west. But the dominant species of grass around the Mississippi was big bluestem, as you say, which is grass that was routinely grew 10 feet tall, which you can imagine when you're trying to get through someplace where there were no tracks, no roads, no paths, and very easy to get disoriented, made travel extraordinarily challenging. I mean, people would get like 10 or 15 feet away from a landmark like a river and then just get lost all day and make no progress at all.
Yeah, go around in circles.
Yeah.
And then occasionally had to worry about tornadoes.
Yeah, and then discovering tornadoes, which even then, although the scientists on the East Coast had been writing about them for years, you know, that was still kind of a specialized audience. People in the rest of the country hadn't really heard about it. They didn't really realize that tornadoes were a major factor in the Midwest until they started settling here.
A question from Dell in Amazemani. Does the Earth's rotation have any effect on the rotation of tornadoes?
No. That was one thing that was a theory that was around. It does on hurricanes. It's called the Coriolis force. And that is why hurricanes turn the way that they do. And it's also where they draw a lot of their energy. Tornadoes are much smaller events. It goes to the same thing, too. People have this idea that water in the northern hemisphere goes down a drain in one direction and the southern hemisphere goes down a drain in the other direction,
yeah,
which is not true. But it's just one of these amazingly persistent myths. Tornadoes basically move rotate counterclockwise, but that is kind of a fluke of the motion of the larger cloud. There many have been observed rotating in the other direction.
Yeah, so they can go either way,
yeah,
in other words.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners, my listeners, are fascinated by weather, and some are even trained weather spotters. Tell us about Corporal John Park Finley, who I bet our trained weather spotters, I bet 99.9% have never heard of him.
Yeah, he was the first professional meteorologist to study tornadoes on the ground. He was with the United States Signal Corps, which after the Civil War was the government agency responsible for weather prediction. And one of the things they did was they sent their staffers around to do field reports on tornadoes whenever they got reports of them in the Midwest. And Finley traveled the furthest. He became completely obsessed with them and became the first person to try to work out a method of predicting them.
And had a pretty colorful career overall.
Yeah. He went through a lot of grief. He was one of these guys who was, and you see this with people who are, you see this computer nerds, weather nerds have this huge problem, is that he was really kind of oblivious to how he was coming off. So he got himself into vast amounts of trouble with various bosses and government overseers because he was so maniacally focused on tornadoes, he just simply couldn't get that they had other interests. So he was working 18, 20 hours a day at some periods of his life, and just doing tornado research, and was amazed that anybody else wouldn't.
And hardly anybody was.
Yeah, no, he was basically alone for most of that time.
It's amazing. Jackie in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Make this quick. My son is 55. When he was an infant, I read an article in Reader's Digest, and it said that you could tell if there might be a tornado by the oppressive heat and by clouds that had what looked like little fingers coming down from there. Is that possible? Is that something that can forecast the possibility of it? There was one that day, a block away.
Yeah.
Well, they're talking about a kind of cloud called a mimetic cumulus, where you do see that sort of, and those have been associated with tornadoes, but they're not a reliable guide. The oppressive heat is a good tip-off just in general for the possibility of severe weather, because a lot of heat near the ground, since hot air rises, if there's a lot of heat near the ground and there's cold air aloft, at some point the atmosphere is going to become unstable and become increasingly chaotic, and that's where violent storms come out of. The specific thing about this one cloud form, that's not the most reliable guy. The most reliable tip-offs now is through radar, which you can now have access to. You know, the National Weather Service and lots of places around the country give you real-time radar, so you can see when violent weather is approaching.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. Now, and that's why I think it's so hard to imagine people in this country not knowing about tornadoes or not.
Well, I'll tell you something. It's not in the book, but this is something that happened to me recently. A couple of years ago, there was a observed rotation, radar rotation, in a cloud that was coming over Chicago, and they sounded the tornado warnings. And my wife happened to be standing on an elevated platform in Chicago, and there were 30 other people there, and she was the only one who knew what the sirens meant.
Ah!
So that shows you, even at the heart of tornado zone in the Midwest, people don't know what to, you know. We're kind of going backward in our knowledge of tornadoes.
Well, kind of going along with that, Cass and Eau Claire wonders if you can outline the scale of severity for tornadoes.
Well, it's a scale that was developed by a man named Ted Fujita. It's known as the Fujita Intensity Scale. It runs from, in his original version, the weakest tornado he gave a value of 0 to, and said that it went up to 5. So F0 through F5. They've now revised it, and they call it the enhanced. So you'll see now they'll say EF0 through EF5. Zero is a tornado with winds under 100 miles an hour that causes almost no damage. And 5 is the strongest tornadoes on records, where winds are been clocked upwards of 300 miles an hour, and those cause unimaginable damage.
Yeah, they're in... We've had a few of them in Wisconsin.
Yeah. They actually have been, you know, somebody was asking earlier about tornado severity. For some reason, there haven't been very many F5s in recent years. There was a horrible one in Joplin, Missouri, a couple of years ago. But the tornado severity has been in a little bit of a lull the last several years. Yeah. And that appears to be, I think, just statistical.
Probably. I was thinking back to Barneveld, Wisconsin. That was an F5. But that's probably 25 years ago.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Something like that. We had an email from Orion in Ripon. What is the highest wind speed and width recorded in a tornado? So how fast and how wide?
The highest wind speed recorded was about 310 miles an hour. But... recording wind speed is very tricky, so nobody really knows what the highest possible speed. Fujita, the scientist I mentioned earlier, said that he thought somewhere in the range of 300 to 325 was physically the highest possible winds you could get anywhere on Earth, much less in a tornado. He thought it was physically impossible for winds to go up much higher than that. As far as anybody knows, he may be right. So that's kind of the upper limit of how fast tornadoes go. You know, they used to believe that tornado damage was caused by air pressure, that there was this area of extremely low pressure at the heart of a tornado, and that vacuum effect caused things to blow up. And now they've concluded it's entirely that wind speed. It's those 300-mile-an-hour winds coming into the funnel.
Yeah, and as you point out, you near the end, you're debunking various myths, and one of them is, run around and open up all your windows.
Yeah, they used to say that when I was a kid. I don't know if they still do. It's about the stupidest thing you could do when a tornado is coming. What you really need to do is take shelter as quickly as possible.
And get and where? Not in the, what is it, the south?
The southwest corner of the basement. Yeah. That's another idea. Both of these ideas have been around since the late 19th century. There's never been much to back them up. The southwest corner is just sort of magic. The safest place you can hide is an interior closet with no windows. Bathrooms are also very good because the piping that surrounds bathrooms gives you that much more protection. So if the tornado is imminent, get into the tub and pull like a mattress over you, and that is really the best you can do. Almost all the deaths caused by tornadoes, it's been discovered recently, are caused by flying debris. So you want to guard yourself from that as much as possible.
And as you point out, even with those high wind speeds, even a piece of cardboard can kill you.
Yeah, it could go straight through a wall. A 300-mile-an-hour wind can cause unimaginable damage.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, we have not here. Boy, we're running out of time. I really wanted to talk some more with you. We had at one point around 1900, we had nobody in the Weather Service in the business of predicting tornadoes or severe weather.
Yeah, I know. When I was researching the book, I was looking through the National Weather Service's archives. And there are eras, especially the early part of the 20th century, where there's just a blank. Nobody was researching it at all. Nobody was doing it. A lot of it is they were under a lot of pressure from real estate people in the Midwest who did not want the idea that tornadoes are a major problem to get out and discourage land sales. So they had official government spokesmen, for instance, one in Iowa, who actually said, Iowa gets one tornado a year. Yeah.
Oh, well, you have so many. One of the things I just loved about the book was all these stories that you have in there. Is there a particular story or a character that really grabbed you that you could tell us about?
You know, I was fascinated by the guy I mentioned earlier. His name was Hagen. He was an expert towards the end. I loved all of these guys, actually. They were a real pleasure to write about. They're so eccentric and fascinating. But there was the guy who came up with the idea of blowing up tornadoes with dynamite. He was an interesting guy.
And you tell a wonderful story about an author who I'm suddenly blanking on his name. I can't think of it now. But he who wrote about a little girl.
Yes. Yes. L. Frank Baum.
Oh.
Yeah, who came up with The Wizard of Oz. And that was really when tornadoes started getting into the popular imagination in a big way.
I'm glad you put that little description that he used of the planes at that point. And I also did not know that he looked at his file cabinet.
Well, that's apparently, yeah, he had two file cabinets. He was looking for the name of a place where Dorothy could go in the tornado, and he had a cabinet labeled A through N and one through labeled O through Z, and he was looking at OZ and thought, well, I'll send her to Oz.
Oh, that's just one of the great stories. Lee, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
And I've got a couple of meteorologists coming on the show right after, right behind you here, so... for those people who are still hanging around with questions about weather, we can...
Well, they would know better than I would.
Well...
No, they're the real guys. I'm just a journalist who got interested.
Well, I'm telling you. Well, they both have copies of your book. I know that for a fact. So, thanks, Lee.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, Lee Sandlin is the author, and he's an award-winning journalist, essayist. He lives in Chicago. Most recent book is Storm Kings: The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. And it is, I'm telling you, it's a fascinating read. He's got lots of stories about, you know, many of these tornadoes. And he's a very engaging writer. So when he's writing about, I just couldn't believe what he's writing about. Ben Franklin riding through the woods after chasing a tornado and hitting the outside of it with his riding crop, trying to get it to break up. It's quite the story. Well, I don't know if Steve Ackerman or John Martin can match those stories, but they're coming up next, and they're here to answer your weather questions. So you stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.